Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/AOIS21. That is www.audibletrial.com/AOIS21. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player.
Welcome to Between the Beltways, a political podcast series from the AOS 21 Podcast Network. Each month, your hosts, Dr. Deepan Chatterjee and Dr. Shreyasi Deb, will explore the races that will shape the central Maryland counties of Howard, Montgomery, and Prince George's in the upcoming midterm elections.
Hi, guys. So in this second episode, we are talking about the Maryland Senate race, some local state races in central Maryland, and then our guest is Arvind Vohra. Vohra is the Libertarian candidate for Maryland Senate and the National Vice President of the Libertarian Party. He is challenging two-time incumbent and Maryland Senior Senator Ben Cardin, a Democrat.
So there's a new poll out for the Maryland Senate race where Cardin is running for re-election, and this is the Goucher College poll, which has Cardin with a 61-17% lead over Chelsea Manning if the race were to be held today. In fact, nearly two-thirds of Maryland Democrats said that they have a positive view of Ben Cardin. However, the same could not be said for Manning. In fact, twice as many Democrats said they have an unfavorable view of Chelsea Manning than have a favorable view, so 37-19%. Even though 44% said they don't have any opinion whatsoever. And Chelsea Manning doesn't really seem to be doing much to introduce herself to Maryland voters either, or to further her cause in the election.
That's right. Recently, there were reports that Manning attended an alt-right event in New York. She later defended herself on a radio show, saying that she was invited and she really wanted to get to know these folks. But many are questioning her relationship with this group. So now moving to the Maryland State Legislature, following the 2014 elections, Democrats kept control of the House by a 91-50 margin, but Republicans did flip 7 seats in that election. As of June 2017, Democrats held 91 seats, 6 more than the 85 seats required to override a gubernatorial veto. Republicans would need to flip 7 seats in 2018 to break up the Democrats' veto-proof majority in the House. Because state delegates in Maryland serve 4-year terms, winning candidates in this election will serve through 2022 and play a role in Maryland's redistricting process. So you can tell that this election is going to be really important for whichever party goes ahead. In Maryland, the primary authority to draw both congressional and state legislative district lines rests with the state legislature. So the results of this election will have impact on both legislature as well as congressional districts.
So moving to a local race in District 9B for the Maryland State Legislature, a district in which we reside, Bob Flanagan, Republican, is running for re-election, and he has been the state delegate in this district since 2014, where he defeated Democrat Tom Cole by a margin of 54-45%. Bob Flanagan is running uncontested in the Republican primary this year. District 9B is very interesting because about 25% of the district is Asian. It's traditionally a Republican district. And to change that, there are two Democrats who are competing in the Democratic primary this year, Courtney Watson and Daniel Medinger. Daniel has a long history of being a journalist, communications expert, and entrepreneur. For 24 years, Dan served as editor and associate publisher of the Catholic Review newspaper for the Archdiocese of Baltimore, which is the largest weekly newspaper in Maryland. In 2009, Dan and his wife, Patty, started their own business Advertising Media Plus in Howard County. This business, Advertising Media Plus, provides communications, media, and development support for many private firms, nonprofits, schools, and organizations. And contesting him in the primary is going to be Courtney Watson, who is currently the Vice President of Sales for the insurance company Rossman, Hart, and Hoffman. She served on the county council for 8 years, beginning in 2006, and she also ran for county executive in 2014, unsuccessfully, narrowly losing to Republican Alan Kittleman, who is currently the county executive of Howard County. So our guest today is Mr. Arvind Vohra, who's running for the U.S. Senate from Maryland on the Libertarian Party ticket, challenging two-time incumbent Senator Ben Cardin, who's a Democrat. Mm-hmm. He's running on a platform to downsize, defund, and eliminate damaging federal government programs. Before starting his own educational business, Arvind studied mathematics and economics at Brown University and then worked as an actuary. After seeing the negative effects of government on business, education, and more, Arvind spent more and more time working for the causes of liberty. He currently spends his time working as the vice chair for the National Libertarian Committee. He's host of the Libertarians Working For You radio show and is a vocal advocate for defunding and downsizing government programs that limit the freedoms of the American people. Welcome, Arvind.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
So my first question to you is, if you are elected U.S. Senator from Maryland in November, what is your vision? What are you going to fight for?
The number one thing I want to fight for is ending the income tax by massively downsizing federal programs. And we're talking about everything from things like the war on drugs, involvement in foreign civil wars, often on both sides, things like the FDA, things like the Department of Agriculture. I'm talking about a government that is small enough to fit inside the Constitution and small enough to be funded without any income tax of any kind.
Okay, that's interesting. So what is your alternative then to collecting income tax? How would Sure. the government be funded?
There's two types of programs the government is doing right now. Some of them are programs that should not be done by anyone at all. The war on drugs, that's $80 billion a year on something that should not be done, period. It is a bad idea. It shouldn't happen at all.
Right.
Some of the programs, things like corn subsidies, again, that's $20 billion a year that should not be done, period. Being involved in foreign civil wars, we're talking about somewhere between $600 and $1 trillion a year that should not be happening at all. So a lot of it isn't figuring out a different way to fund a thing. It's just to not do the thing in the first place. Then there are going to be some things that people actually like. People actually like roads. People actually like education. But those are things that, because people actually want, are things that can be provided, in my opinion, much more effectively by the free market at a higher quality, at lower cost, at superior variety, in every way better. So those are the two things, and I'm really focusing heavily on getting government out of every single area that it is wedged itself into, in my opinion, both unconstitutionally and just in an illogical and ineffective way.
So it's interesting. You talked about education, and I think you have revolutionized a certain method of teaching. Is that right?
That's true. That's true. Yeah. I mean, and the good thing is I can work in the free market, private sector part of education. It's unregulated. There's no government involvement. And I'm able to do a lot of exciting things. And many of my competitors are also able to do a lot of exciting things. The biggest waste are so many great and talented teachers whose skills are being squandered in the bureaucratically mismanaged, backwards government school system. A big thing that libertarians support is ending all government schools, all government-funded schools, and allowing only free market, private enterprise to innovate and provide things that are low cost, provide things that are sometimes even free, mm-hmm. but are actually designed to lead to student excellence rather than to just, you know, pad the coffers of teachers' unions and other special interest groups.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned your objection to the war on drugs. So as we all know, the raging opioid epidemic is devastating families and communities across the country and costing a lot to taxpayers. Do you foresee or plan to end the war on drugs, solving the opioid crisis in any way?
I think it's going to help a lot, and here's why. Currently, what we have is people who are living in a state of fear when it comes to, you know, things related to drugs. So, for example, you often have people who are addicted to a drug, who are trying to get unaddicted. They're trying to break the addiction.
Sure.
Their friends and family want them to break the addiction. The government, everyone wants them to break the addiction, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're working and they're striving and they're almost there. And then what happens? They slip up. Why? It's addictive. People make mistakes, whatever. They slip up and now all of a sudden they're locked in a government cage, which is going to increase their stress. It's going to increase their chance of slipping back. They're worried about financial pressures now. You know, when everyone is on board, the person, their family, everyone wants this addiction to end, and the government is stepping in and preventing it from basically happening, that's a problem. To me, if we end the war on drugs, you see huge differences. Number one, you're going to see that people can get the violence out of the drug situation. Listen, I'm not a fan of drugs, but the biggest issue to me right now is violence. Imagine if drug businesses could settle disagreements by, you know, calling their credit card company, selecting a Dropbox on Amazon.com instead of resorting to violence. Imagine if people could get whatever drug they wanted and would have a preference towards less harmful drugs than what we have right now, where you have drugs that have random mixtures and additives and God knows what in them. Imagine if drugs were bought and sold the way everything else is. And yeah, maybe some people would do them, but at least you'd be taking out a lot of the damaging parts of it, the unexpected addiction, when something unexpected is put into a less dangerous drug, or the huge amounts of violence. That's what we can get rid of right away by ending the drug war.
So I take it that you're for the legalization of marijuana as well as other drugs?
I believe that all drugs should be as legal to buy and sell as tomatoes.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Very good.
Interesting.
Okay. So my next question is, do you think you have a realistic chance to win against Senator Cardin, given that, you know, he's had a long political career? I believe it's 50 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
He's never lost a single race in his political career in the state legislature as well as, you know,
the U.S. Congress.
So what do you think are your chances, and how are you trying to improve your chances against
him? There's a couple things that come to mind. I mean, the first is the political career has been long, but it's been mostly bad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has supported all of these damaging programs. Mm-hmm. He supported welfare, he supported the drug war, he supported foreign wars, he supported everything wrong with government. So the question comes down to basically information. Can I get that message to voters that, listen, I'm trying to end the war on drugs. I'm trying to bring the troops home so they're no longer squandering their lives and we're no longer squandering money on these foreign actions that are actually making us less safe? Can I get the message out there that we can actually end the income tax? We don't even need to cut government by that much to do it. Just cutting it to 1992 levels, cutting government spending today to 1992 levels would be enough to end the income tax. Can I get that message out there? And a big part of it is, to what extent can we get that media coverage? You know, doing shows like yours are so important because it gets the message out there. So many people want to see these changes happen. They just don't know that there are people trying to make them happen. So they, you know, vote by default. They're like, you know, I guess I voted this guy last time. Maybe I'll vote him this time. I didn't like any of the things he did. I disagree with everything. But, you know, I guess the devil you know is maybe better. I want to show them that there is something better, that we can dramatically downsize, defund, and reduce the size and the scope of government. I think that's going to be a message that, if we can get that message out, there's going to make a big difference.
I agree with you about that, because I think one of the disadvantages of this political system is the two-party system, where you're almost forced to, like, you know, pledge allegiance mm-hmm. to one of those big parties, and you don't have other voices like yours out there where people even know that, hey, you know, we have a credible candidate who's running on the Libertarian Party ticket for Senate, who we need to listen to, who has, you know, ideas that may be very, very attractive to a lot of voters. So I appreciate candidates like you who are giving voice, you know, a different kind of voice to the dialogue. It's not either D or R, it's something else. It's, you know, I really appreciate that.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, one of the big things that we want to do, in addition to trying to win, is actually spread that message. You know, so many people, and even me, I was surprised that even that there could be an idea like ending all government schools, ending all public schools. I was so ingrained in this old way of thinking that I didn't even think about these alternatives. When it comes to things like money, I didn't even think that we could have, you know, this private sector money, you know, cryptocurrencies and whatnot. I just didn't think about it. And I think a big part of what's mm-hmm. important about these types of campaigns is that we are spreading powerful ideas. And each year, in 2016, the Libertarian Party got 4 times as many votes as our previous record. And the previous record was just set a couple of years before that.
Right.
We're seeing huge differences. Mm-hmm.
So, if elected, you pledge to sponsor legislation that will eliminate the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, and Medicare Part D. Can you say some more on how that is going to help Marylanders in particular?
Sure. Right now, if you have a rare disease, you will almost certainly never see a cure. Not because the cures don't exist or because they can't be made, but because the regulatory costs put by the FDA are so high that essentially functional drugs are left on lab benches. And that is unconscionable, that we are basically saying that, you know, if your disease is so uncommon that you're never going to recoup the costs, that a company will never be able to recoup the costs, you're never going to see a cure. That's leaving Marylanders, that's leaving Americans at cold, and that's something we need to stop doing. The way to do that, in my opinion, is ending the FDA. One of the most insane parts of the FDA is the efficacy requirement, which says that you not have to prove that a drug is safe, but that you have to prove that it actually works against all these other things. It sounds like a good idea in principle, but A, you're not testing safety, and B, you're adding a huge amount to the cost. What makes it even more insane is so many drugs are prescribed off-label. That means they're approved by the FDA for one thing,
mm-hmm.
and then prescribed for a different thing. I mean, that's a waste of money. We're wasting billions on this kind of nonsense bureaucracy. What I want to see is this. When you buy a drug today, you are usually already consulting with an expert. You are consulting with an expert in that field before you buy it anyway. So it's not like we're just kind of floating in the cold and don't know what's happening. I say end the FDA, let doctors make these decisions, let patients make the decisions with their own bodies, let's see the cost of drugs go from these exorbitant levels to much, much lower. At the same time, I want to end all border protections for pharmaceutical companies. That means Americans should be able to import drugs, import medicines from any country they want to.
So there is some discussion in the U.S. Congress right now, and I believe the president's budget also talks about it, the right to try legislation. What do you think about that?
It's a good first step. It's not a bad idea. The right to try says if you have a terminal disease, you want to try an experimental drug, instead of waiting for 11 years for approval, if you only have 6 months to live, you have the right to try it out. And it's a good idea. I think it's a good philosophical idea as well. To really get where we need to go, where the drugs are actually affordable, we need to get rid of the FDA. And another part of that, of course, is in my opinion, we need to get rid of things like Medicare, Medicaid that are driving up the price of medicines. You can see what happens when you get government and insurance just a little bit out. With LASIK, we saw something that's basically science fiction technology that requires skilled labor to use go from several thousand per eye to a few hundred dollars an eye. At the same time, we saw the highly regulated and subsidized EpiPen go up from about $100 up to a few hundred dollars. That's the cost of regulation. That's the cost of government. That's what happens when you have backwards incentive. I say get government completely and totally out of medicine so it becomes as affordable as everything else should be.
So your ideas are very innovative, and I'm so glad that you're so passionate about them. I'm curious, what are your policy alternatives in the areas where there could be market failure, where the market might not want to get in to say, I'm just thinking on my feet, ensure individuals with very expensive conditions, with disabilities who need nursing home level of care, professional level of care all their lives, things like that. If we eliminate all these public programs, what would be your policy alternative to support individuals like these in our society?
So the question of how do we work with individuals with needs is a question that has been a part of human society for all of human society. It's not a new question, and it mm-hmm. didn't just come into existence once we had a multi-trillion dollar federal government. They have been handled in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I look at the two sides of it. One is the cost side. Medical care should not be as expensive as it is.
Sure.
It is this expensive because things like Medicare and Medicaid are driving up the price. You hear doctors that will often change their fees because they want to make sure that they're getting the most they can out of Medicare, you know, once Medicare pays an amount, they'll raise their rates to that amount. And that's just showing we're removing that price incentive. There's no price incentive to figure out ways to do things more cheaply. So the first is get rid of Medicare so that the incentive to lower costs is still there. We've already seen it work with LASIK. The incentive to lower costs works and makes things that were once the privilege of the ultra-wealthy affordable to almost anyone. The other side of that is the charitable side. When you have more of your money, when you're not being taxed with more than half your income being used for purposes that you probably don't agree with in the first place, when you can stop that, one, people have more money for charity. When you don't have to work so many hours because you're not having your money stolen, you have more time to spend on charity. There are so many cultures where doctors will donate some amount of time, where churches and other organizations will help provide care. In America, though, right now, churches that try to provide that kind of care, try to provide housing for the homeless, are often, they get fined, they get arrested by the government. That needs to turn around. We need to have the right to be able to express our right to help others in need without government interference.
Yeah, I think I read of somebody who was trying to feed the homeless. I'm forgetting the name of the city, and one of the U.S. cities, and he was arrested or trying to.
That's happened many times.
Right.
The problem is that's not one city. I wish it was just one city. We tell that one city, listen, guys, get your act together. It's many cities. I mean, we saw in Las Vegas, the casinos no longer can give the buffet food at the end of the day to the homeless because of the government. In New York, Jewish grandmothers used to get together in synagogues to bake bagels for the homeless. They can't do that anymore. One organization wanted to set up showers for the homeless so that they could, you know, have that human dignity of cleanliness.
Right.
That was shut down by New York. And we see this time and time again that the state is trying to blockade that natural human kindness, that natural impulse to charity. It is part of us. If it wasn't part of us, they wouldn't need to pass a law against it.
So my final question to you is, there has been some controversy about some of your current statements regarding age of consent laws within your own party. So what do you think of that? What do you have to say about that?
Sure. I am no stranger to controversy with the Libertarian Party, outside of the Libertarian Party. And I believe that my job is to tell the truth. It is not to sugarcoat it. It is not to lie about it. It's not to pretend that it's otherwise. I do not believe that the government has any business of any kind being involved in education. I don't believe the government has any business being involved at all in marriage. I also do not believe the government has any business being involved in sex because they do everything wrong. The government does not have the ability to do anything like that. Things like sex, in my opinion, should be handled by family, by culture, by community. Those types of discussions should not be involving government in any way whatsoever. And I know that that's a controversial position. That's fine, because I would rather stand on a controversial position that I know is right than be afraid to stand up for what I know is true.
Right. So how are you trying to counter the the opposition in your own party, I guess, that is coming your way? And you're in the party leadership, the national party leadership. So how are you trying to counter the voices of opposition within your own party?
I don't really view it as countering them. I mean, we're on the same team, so I'm not really trying to counter them. I'm trying to embolden them. I do think that many times libertarians, you're always a minority, so you get afraid of speaking the truth. You know that government schools have to go right now. You know there's no justification for something like that. But you also know that they're popular in some communities. You don't want to say anything. You start to, focus on small issues that aren't going to cause controversy. I want to live the example that I want to see other people in the party do. I want other people in the party to feel okay saying, yes, end government schools right now. Get government completely out of marriage. If you're an adult, if you want to marry 15 people of 12 different genders, that's your business. If you want to educate your kids however you want, that's your business. If you want to donate to charity, fine. If you don't want to, that's your right. That's the kind of messaging I want to see from the Libertarian Party as a whole. I want to make sure that we are going to be opposed for what we believe rather than loved for what we don't believe. And so a big part of what I'm doing is trying to encourage people to speak the libertarian truths. My view on age of consent is not a new libertarian view. It's the exact view held by Dr. Mary Ruart, who was one of the candidates for the libertarian nomination for president in 2004. It is held by Murray Rothbard, one of the major fathers of libertarian thought. It is a very basic libertarian view. It is incendiary to many, But if we're not going to fight for our actual thoughts, then we're not really going to be able to fight for the principles that we believe in.
All right, I think that's a good note to end on. I would like to thank you for your time. That was Arvind Vohra, who's running for U.S. Senate on the Libertarian Party ticket.
Thank you so much, Arvind, and good luck.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Very inspiring and very passionate. Thanks.
This has been Between the Beltways, a production of the AOS 21 Podcast Network. Find it each month on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Google Play, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.aois21.com. Keep up with the news between episodes on our Facebook at facebook.com/btbeltways, on Twitter at btbeltways, and on our WordPress blog, betweenthebeltways.wordpress.com.
Copyright 2018, AS21 Media, LLC. All rights reserved. AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?